Hello to all of you boys next door, mums and dads, new weds and nearly deads, and welcome to Dangerous Amusements, a podcast where we talk about the music of Elvis Costello. I'm Stu Arrowsmith, and on each episode I'm joined by a special guest to chat all things Elvis, and I ask them to help me compile the ultimate Elvis Costello playlist. Don't make any sudden movements, because these are Dangerous Amusements. Joining me on this episode is a writer, editor, and music podcaster. Welcome to Dangerous Amusements, Courtney E. Smith.
I'm so happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, you're more than welcome. Thank you for coming on. How are you?
Doing good. Trying to stay warm in our, you know, winter, air quotes, winter.
Yes, a Texas winter.
Yes, but I am in North Texas, so it's a bit more serious. Just a touch. Yeah.
Okay, our sympathy levels have dropped a little bit. I've been listening to your podcast, Songs My Ex Ruined, which is such a great idea for a show. That's doing so well, and you've had so much great feedback on it. You must be thrilled with how that's going.
Yeah, it's going great. Every episode is so much fun to do because it's like there is a standard story of people who've had some teenage heartbreak and this song reminds them of that. But every now and then, really more often than every now and then, we get a crazy story. We've had full on death and destruction. We've had cheating. We've had like there've been some very dramatic episodes. I mean, it's fascinating to hear the stories, and the songs have become almost never what I expect them to be.
Well, that's the thing with music, isn't it? Life events change how you listen to them, or they add this whole weight of another experience to them as well. So it's such a good idea to hone in on that in the show.
Yeah, everybody has that story, almost. There have been a few people who've declined to come on because they're like, yeah, I just don't, nobody's ever ruined a song for me. And I'm just like, okay, glad to know you're dead inside. Cool.
I don't think we've had any Elvis Costello songs that somebody's ex has ruined on the show yet. Is that a possibility further down the line, do you think?
I mean, I hope so. I would really commiserate with them. There are some Elvis songs I think that I could let go of forever if someone ruined for me, but there are so many more that I would be very upset. And we try to encourage people to reclaim songs once they've been ruined. So obviously that's the way we would go for pretty much every song, unless it was like This Year's Model or Party Girl or something. And if it's a derogatory song towards you in the relationship, maybe you could just let that one go.
Yeah. Well, let's talk a bit about Elvis Costello then. We're going to get on to some incredible gig reminiscences on your half that will make me very jealous when we get to them. But we'll get to that in due course. When did you first become familiar with his music?
So it was in the early 2000s when Rhino started re-releasing a lot of the albums, and I'd listened to his stuff and knew it casually before that. Like, I grew up in a household where Allison was on the radio and, you know, the normal stuff that everybody knew. But I really started studying it and listening more deeply with those re-releases. And I had a lot of friends, guy friends, who were record nerds before that, who were really into him. So he was on my radar, but it was just something I hadn't made a study of. And I started to, because I started getting those albums, and it's such, like, they're so good. And I went chronologically, you know, from first on through as the releases came out, which went on for years. And it was such an interesting study to talk about it. And it was an interesting time too, because I was living in New York and post-punk revival was huge, in the scene of the Strokes and Interpol. So those songs were playing at a lot of bars as well. And people were talking about Elvis Costello in this renewed way for those reasons. And not long after that, he would have his TV show on, what was it? Not Bravo, but one of those
Sundance
networks.
Was it over your
The Sundance Channel. That's right. That also caused like a lot of interesting conversation around him. So yeah, that was the era when I dove in and got to really intimately know Elvis Costello. And it was also interesting because of all the outtakes on those albums to do the comparison listens. It really gives you this insight into him, especially if that's your first time really giving it a true listen, that it lets you see so much of his development, I thought.
Yeah, I was going to say that's a pretty intense way to first get into his music, yeah. is to buy Get Happy with 50 tracks on it or something yeah. like that.
Yeah. That one took a while to go through, honestly. That one took a lot of parsing.
Yeah, yeah. And was that an immediate hit for you when you started listening to Elvis? Were you instantly on board?
Oh, yeah, like the first three albums. I mean, My Aim Is True is okay. And it's like not the greatest, I think. But everything after that, all of the stuff in the 70s is just remarkable. Remarkable songwriting. And the way that he pushes forward, like I fell in love with him for his lyricism and the quips and the references and the double entendres, triple entendres, so all the things he does, the acrobatics of it. But gosh, the way that he pushed songwriting forward in post-punk, when it was, there's him and there's Gang of Four, you know, and everybody else is just kind of like, we got to do artier punk, but they're like really making this statement, I think. And it's very political. It's very heavy with emotion. And it's also just like, you could spend so much time, as much time as you would spend analyzing any sonnet, figuring out what Elvis yes. Costello is talking about.
Yeah. And you were saying your group were interested in Elvis as well. So you knew quite a lot of other people into his music at that time. At a fairly, what would you have been, early 20s then, something like
yes,
that?
Yes, early yeah. 20s then. Oh my God, yeah. Oh, just a bunch of music nerds. And a lot of them still lived in Dallas and I had moved to New York. So I remember having long distance phone calls with my friend Chad, talking way too in depth about our thoughts on early Elvis Costello albums around this time.
Yeah. Brilliant. It's great, though, isn't it, when you discover it for the first time and you are suddenly presented, particularly, you know, you and I come in later into his career and you've just got this whole catalogue to explore. It's such an exciting thing to go through, isn't it?
It really is. And it's just, it's so interesting because also if you're going chronologically, you don't know what you're going to get into. Like, I was aware that he pivoted later on, but once I got to the 90s, I was just like, oh, so many pivots. Okay, this is kind of fascinating. Like, what will it be next? Good Lord.
Yeah. Oh, great. Well, we were saying before we started recording, one of my favorite things about any episode is, apart from the recording itself, is when my guests email in the songs that you're going to put onto the playlist and talk about. And your list is brilliant as well. So I can't wait to get stuck into these. So the rules, as everyone knows by now, you've picked out six of your favorite Elvis songs for me. They'll go on the playlist, Powder and Perfume, at the end of the season. And it has to be one song from each decade of Elvis's career. And we're going to start, of course, in the 1970s.
Accidents will happen when all the hit and run. Used to be a victim, now you're not the only one. Accidents will happen when all the hit and run. I don't want to hear it because I know what I've done. To begin, though he says he'll wait forever, it's now or never, but they keep him hanging on. They're still a champion, just says you can't go home without a chaperone.
And this is Accidents Will Happen, the live version from Hollywood High.
So this is one that I heard for the first time. I have this very strong memory of it. So I quit my job at MTV and moved to LA. I quit in 2008 and it was a big layoff for the whole company. And obviously the economic downturn that happened in 2008 affected a ton of people. It was very stupid of me to quit my job then. Like I volunteered for layoffs. And now looking back, I'm just like, wow, I really should have taken all of that a lot more seriously. But I decided to reboot my life. I moved to LA and I was going to write a book, which I did. It's called Record Collecting for Girls. If you'd like to go get yourself a copy, there is some Elvis Costello in it. And someone I'd worked with in the music industry who'd also been laid off from a different company started a bootleg club around that same time. And he would just email out these bootleg albums he'd been collecting for years. And it was really all over the place, but in 2009 at some point he sent out this concert. And I know that it got released as an album properly a few years after this, after that, not too long after that. But I remember driving around in LA listening to this album, literally driving by Hollywood High listening to this album sometimes on purpose, because like, why would you not slip it on? But it was so interesting. And I picked this song because I think about the Burt Bacharach collaboration in the 90s and having a vague sense of that happening. It wasn't the music I was listening to at the time, but like hearing that and just being like, huh, what? Okay, interesting. And now going back and listening to this recording from the 70s and this particular song that kicks off that album, the stripped down version of it, you can hear already the homage to Bacharach. You can hear the influence there. I think it's really beautiful. I haven't heard a version that sounds like this one in any of his other From the Vault recordings. So I love it, but it's also totally an anathema. If you know this song, you know the album it's off of, you're just like, what is this man doing? This is not, what? Yeah. And that kind of sums up Elvis Costello and what to me makes him such an interesting artist.
Yeah, and Elvis had identified that Bacharach link as well. He said, I recall working on Accidents Will Happen in a stifling motel room in Arizona. In my mind, I was writing something styled after the Bacharach song, Anyone Who Had a Heart, even though I understood little of the mechanics of such a composition. And of course, they go on to be such great collaborators many years later, but that influence was there from such a young age for Elvis, wasn't it? And I just love the fact that you can have the version that opens Armed Forces, but then you get the ballad version as well. And yeah, neither is better than the other. They're both sort of wonderful versions in their own right, aren't they?
It's almost like he's letting you peek inside of an alternate universe or the other ideas of Elvis Costello. He's not just the angry young man. He is a gifted songwriter who recognizes the beauty of pop music. And so much of like early Elvis wasn't treated that way. It was styled by design as outsidery, angry, disjointed, guitar-driven rock, which also isn't true. Anybody that's heard Steve Neve's keyboards knows that.
Yeah.
So it's nice to hear this, you know, what could have been, what maybe should have been, but didn't work within the context of who Elvis was at that time.
Yeah. And of course, as you've been going through your getting used to his songs through the reissues and all these alternate takes, different versions, it wouldn't have been strange for you to get a live version where he's singing it completely differently to what you know from the record as well, because you'd been kind of indoctrinated in that through getting the extended reissues as well. This is what he does.
True. It's just like the sparseness of it and the melodic tone in his voice, which is not really something that's highlighted at that point in his career, is so different. And I wish I could have been like, I so wonder what the reaction was in the crowd. You can hear a bit of whenever they're interacting with the song, but it's very sparse, especially compared to other parts of the record. It's very sparse. And I think it was probably very surprising. Surprising to hear this.
Yeah. Well, I don't think you can be envious of people who are at that gig, because as we'll get to later on, you've been to some incredible gigs that make me very envious as well, which I know people have pointed out is a bit of a recurring theme on the podcast. I get very jealous of some of the American shows that you guys have been to and I haven't. But this is a great performance. And of course, the recorded version comes out on Armed Forces in January 1979, Elvis and the Attractions, recording that one and produced by Nick Lowe. I want to go straight into the 80s and go straight onto your next choice and a brilliant album opener. Just begun. I asked for water, We're 4 years into the podcast, and this is the first time anyone has picked Uncomplicated, which surprises me because it's such a great song and such a great way to start Blood and Chocolate, isn't it? Really gets you into the mood of that record straight away.
Yeah, it does. This one is almost an homage to my podcast because no one has ruined this song for me, but it is something I repeat a lot whenever breakups happen. I don't know, thematically, it seems to be on point for how my relationships end, and I can relate to it very strongly. But it is, it's such a, it's like you open a record with a thesis statement, and he's almost glib about it, like the way that he goes about delivering this song. It's, to me, this is one of the great character records where he's putting on this guy, and it's this sort of toxic guy who, you know, you can't really be this person. You can't really. And to the condescension in this song, like these are the things we think in our head about people that you could never, never say. But you have to. I mean, to protect your own mental space, to keep your peace, to sort of write your own narrative after something goes wrong, everybody has these thoughts, whether you want to admit to them or not, and they are unkind and they're terrible, but they're also the thoughts that you have to have, you need to have in a vulnerable moment. So I chose it because I overly identify with this bad guy. Sometimes we are the bad guy, and that's okay. Like, as long as you're not out there doing the damage, destroying someone else's world, telling them how they think and feel. Mm. I think it's okay to just be that person in the privacy of your own stereo.
Yeah. And musically, it kind of matches the mood of the lyric as well, doesn't it? It's so claustrophobic. Oh, and, you know, Elvis has spoken of, they're all on the studio floor, everything's bleeding into the next speaker. And it captures the intensity that he's got in the words as well.
Well, also, where was he at with The Attractions at this point? Is this like the album where they're either breaking up or very close to breaking up?
Yeah, so this is the final one before they break up. And obviously right. They reconvene for a couple of records in the 90s. But essentially that run of records comes to an end with this one. It was released in September 86. They'd already had the kind of the tension, I suppose, of doing King of America when Elvis only used them on one of the final tracks. And then he's spoken about, you know, creating this mood in the studio where they were a bit pissed off with him. And it comes through in the playing, but it all goes into the melting pot to create this intense record, Blood and Chocolate.
That is in the liner notes for the reissue, which are, that's another great thing about those reissues is the perspective of time and space made them very honest. Mm. And he talks pretty frankly about how bad things were going and had gone and the creative differences that they're starting to experience. And how uncomfortable recording all of this was, how much everyone didn't like doing it. And I think this to me is the moment where things become really interesting because the Elvis Costello people think that they like a lot of people who are maybe more casual fans ends right here when he goes off to explore not just other things, but wildly different things. This is a, there's also, as much as this song is an opening salvo, there's also a period, like it's the end of a sentence as well. And I think the smugness, you know, is directed at what's happening right in front of him.
Hmm. Yeah. Elvis performing this one with Steve Naive, Bruce Thomas and Pete Thomas, Nick Lowe and Colin Fairley are the producers for this one. It was recorded in Olympic Studios. And Elvis said, "Uncomplicated was my latest failed attempt to write a song based on one chord. I played Telecaster for much of this album, giving my parts a very harsh edge. The intro of Uncomplicated will give you the idea. From then, it all hangs on the stupid beat that Nick Lowe suggested until we finally get off the one chord and Steve brings in the chorus." And I love the little touches, the horse that does arithmetic and you get that banging on the, I think it's an anvil, isn't it, in the mix as well. It's even though it's pretty moody, there are little witty touches all the way through as well.
Yeah, it's also time at this point for Elvis and Nick Lowe to go their separate ways. Like, they have weirdly defined each other as songwriters and producers to that point. And I think creatively, God, that really ran its course. It was great. And then it was like, you know, we really, we've got to explore other people.
Yeah.
Monogamy is tough, especially in songwriting.
That's right. And I suppose just thinking about what you were saying before, the how heavy this period is, and it comes to an end with The Attractions. This then becomes the longest gap between records in Elvis's career, the 3 years between Blood and Chocolate and Spike. So yeah, maybe it was a case of, okay, let's just breathe in for a little bit. I mean, he does other things in that period, of course, playing live, recording with McCartney and writing with McCartney. But in terms of Costello Records, this is the longest break we get.
Yeah, it's like he gets off the hamster wheel of being a new artist, which is crazy because he was so not a new artist by that point. But the way that the record release schedules worked then, it was like, have a record out every year or else you're done, which is where we're at now, too. That's how artists, it's circled back to that. And it's so interesting that finally this is the point where he exercises that power of like, I don't have to do this anymore. I'm bigger than this. And bigger than the radio cycle.
Yeah. The end of that first phase with The Attractions. They will come together for a few recordings a few years later. But for now, it is the close of that chapter, as you say. Let's move into the 1990s for the next song that you've picked out. And what a great choice this one is. It's Elvis performing a real classic song written by someone else. Just introduce this one for us.
So this is Elvis doing what he refers to as a little American folk song, It's God Only Knows, with the Brodsky Quartet, as previously done by California's The Beach Boys.
I may not always love you, as long as there are stars above you. You never need to doubt it. I'll make you so sure about it. God only knows what I'd be without you.
This is Elvis Costello and the Brodsky Quartet with a performance of God Only Knows. They released a version on the Juliet Letters, the expanded version, and the version that we're hearing there was from a performance at the BBC, which was released as the concert film A Case for Song. And I suppose any time that you take on one of the real totemic songs in popular music, it's, I don't know, would you describe it as a risk if you do something as great as God Only Knows? But they do it their own way here, and this is a beautiful performance.
It's a huge risk, and it makes a big statement to take on a song that is so definitively belonging to another artist and twist it into your own sound, which in this case is operatic. It is completely transformed.
Yeah. When did you first come to this one?
So this is another one from the Rhino collection. I never in a million years would have listened to this in the 90s. I was deep into Hole and The Breeders and Alanis Morissette. Like, this was not up my alley even remotely. It wasn't even on the map. And this was actually the first thing I listened to when I got that album. I was just like, wait a minute, is this going to be? Oh, yes, it is. Wow. 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 Okay. And it's gorgeous. It's beautiful. It's Elvis's voice like I'd never, ever heard it. This challenge he seems to have given himself to turn into an opera singer across the whole album is fascinating. But to hear this interpretation of such a well-known pop song is nothing short of fascinating. And I think we should mention, this is not a widely available song. You're not going to be able to go to Spotify and find it. So even though it was on the extended release album of the Brodsky Quartet, the Juliet Letters, it's just not been, nobody's made it a priority to make any of those extended tracks. I believe there are only four of them available. So I also went to find the BBC version on YouTube to listen to it for this record, just to make sure it was available somewhere so that you could get it in case you didn't have the album. So I would imagine that's maybe why it hasn't come up for people on the podcast before. It is a very nerdy, deep cut choice that you cannot just get your hands on.
Yeah. But you can't just do a note-for-note version because it's not going to be as good as the version that's on Pet Sounds because that's such an iconic piece of music. So they have this arrangement with the Brodsky Quartet. I mean, as everyone knows, that's Michael Thomas, Ian Belton, Paul Cassidy and Jacqueline Thomas. Music composed by Brian Wilson, the lyrics by Tony Asher, who was an advertising executive at one point and then ends up writing one of the most wonderful opening lines to a pop song that there's ever been, I think. And one that, from when you read about it, was one that Brian Wilson wasn't very happy with when he says, you can't start a song by saying, I may not always love you. And Tony Asher said, well, hang on, wait till you hear what the second line is.
Look, this is the one of the most ambitious things I feel like Elvis Costello's ever done. And he's, especially in this decade, a person with a lot of ambition and a lot of exploration. He really and truly makes this his own. Just the way he handles moving through the scale, the rearrangement of the notes is so surprising. I feel surprised by it every time I listen to it. Pet Sounds, to me, is the most perfect album ever made. And that's not an uncommon opinion. Many, many music critics think the same. It is a triumph as an album. So to be able to, I wouldn't say improve on that, but to make a unique version that is also captivating is truly a feat. That is a remarkable thing to do. And this, I feel like, is such a remarkable choice in a decade full of remarkable choices by Elvis Costello. The way that he dived into so many different genres, that he grafts this piece of Americana onto European opera is so cool. Like, I mean, how do you not love that? This is the thing that makes me become a more invested fan of Elvis Costello than someone who wants to put his records on at 2 a.m. and dance to them as a 20-something. Mm. It's the intellectualism of this exercise is something that I love, but that doesn't mean that there's not a ton of heart to it.
Mm. Yeah. And that's a great DVD as well, isn't it? A case for song Elvis performing with the Reunited Attractions, but then breaking off to do a little piece with the Brodsky Quartet as well. That's one of those that I just happily rewatch that over and over again.
It's so cool. And his enthusiasm throughout the whole thing is so apparent too. Like something switched, you know, something in his mind. I know that he didn't go to therapy, but he should have. But it's that sort of transformation of just like someone who's free again. And maybe it's all the working with Baccarat and Alan Toussaint and everything else that happened in this decade that made it joyful for him again. Mm. But yeah, this is the guy who he becomes for the next 20 years, somebody who really enjoys exploring music.
Yeah. Elvis, of course, not the only person to cover God Only Knows. It's been done by such a wide range of performers, from David Bowie to Taylor Swift. Paul McCartney performed a live duet with Brian Wilson in LA in 2002, and the Beatles described God Only Knows as the greatest song ever written. So I don't think praise comes much higher than that.
The Beatles are right, and Bowie should have not done that. Nor should Taylor Swift. Feel free to at me, I don't care.
Courtney E. Smith on X, if you want to take issue with any of the comments and opinions shared in this episode.
Cool.
You did it because you wanted alibi, alibi. And you took it because you needed alibi, alibi. As much as I hate your guts. Alibi, alibi.
Okay, this is your song choice from the 2000s, and this one takes us to the album When It Was Cruel, which was released in 2002. And this is a great track for me. This is Alibi.
Okay, this one is a lot more personal for me. So at this point, I'd started working at MTV, and the release of When I Was Cruel dovetails with my getting into Rhino's reissues, and my music nerd friends were very much about this album. So when I got a promo of it, I listened and I was like, oh, yes, it is as heralded the return of Elvis Costello rocker to his post-punk sort of era with a little bit of goth like elements tossed in there, and a little bit of almost R&B elements. I don't know. The drums are just very different. So I loved it. And Alibi was the song that got me right off the bat. But this was also when I got to meet Elvis Costello, was on the promo tour for this album.
Yeah. Tell us about this.
So this was probably a year after it came out, and it's on Island Records in the U.S., and MTV2 booked him to host an episode of their rock show, I believe it was. And I was not someone who would normally ask to go down to the studio for anything. Like, it's very obnoxious. But when Elvis Costello came in, I was like, could I go down and meet him? And they said, sure. And so I got there early and walked back and forth in front of the green room like an absolute nerd, like a stalker, let's be honest. It was creepy. And I know I saw him like check me and see that I was out there, but I didn't have any like worse energy than, you know, the other people roaming around the halls down there. There are plenty of staff. So it was fine. And I got to meet him and he was so nice. Like when we met face to face, he definitely realized that I was overly enthusiastic very quickly. Okay. But he was very indulgent about it. And we talked for a good bit about his love of Destiny's Child, which was a thing he talked about a lot on the promo tour for this album, and Italian television game shows. I had been not too recently to Florence, to Italy for the first time, and was totally captivated by the weirdness of their daytime television programming. And he also had recently been to Italy. Okay. And we talked about it a lot because it's quite remarkable. And just, you know, anything else I could think of to desperately keep the conversation going. And it was really sweet. And then the segments he taped for MTV2 were the Wheel of Fortune, which I think was around the time that he started doing the tours that were the spinning wheel tours. So it was sort of like his tour in a mini way came on MTV, and they were all rigged up with various questions about music for him. So it was an adorable taping segment too.
Yeah. Oh, so a good experience. That's nice to hear, because you never know.
Yes.
You never know with anyone when you engage with them, never mind that it's a hero or someone whose music you really love. You never know quite how it's going to go. So to have a great experience is a really cool thing.
Can I tell you that I felt like I was really taking a chance, because I had met some of my other heroes. When I had interned at MTV before that, I met REM, who are also in my top artists of all time.
Don't spoil REM for me, Courtney.
I won't tell you what happened, but it wasn't good. And it continued to not be good for all of the 2000s. And it was just deeply disappointing. But it was fine as long as I never attempted to speak to them again.
Oh, no.
But
the only way this will work is if I take my headphones off, I'll let you tell the listeners what happened and I won't listen to what went on.
I mean, I'll tell you if you want to hear it.
No, I don't. I don't want to hear it.
Deeply disappointing.
Let's not spoil Monster and New Adventures in Hi-Fi and Automatic for the People for me when I listen to them again.
Okay.
But your Elvis experience was great. Did you chat about the new record him as well?
Yes. I mean, we talked about the Tear Off Your Own Head song, which was the single, and that's kind of how we got into Destiny's Child. He was just very interested in girl groups, and the Bangles were a part of it, and they were on that album, as I recall. So there was just something with that sort of Paisley Park, Paisley Underground, and the hip-hop R&B vibes of there were so many of those cute girl groups in the 2000s as well. And he clearly was clocking all of them. So that was surprising at the time and very interesting source of inspiration for him to say that he'd tapped into.
Yeah. And a little learning point for everyone listening in, if you do bump into Elvis, you can speak to him about daytime Italian TV and the conversation will just flow from there. So there you go. Just want to take home with you that little tip.
Look, if you've ever seen it, you know there's a lot to say. It's okay. Very weird.
Okay. And as you say, Alibi Now is, I guess, something that takes you back to that time when you listen to the song, is it?
Oh my gosh. When I put headphones on and listen to that song, I am instantly in the subway station at an L stop, either 8th Avenue or Williamsburg, because those were the ones I was in constantly, waiting on a train, and it's a little bit stinky, and I'm listening to Elvis Costello. It just feels very parked in that time in my life.
Yeah. This is a great track, though, as well. I mean, it's sneery, it's angry, it's got that really choppy guitar sound in it as well. And as you say, the hype around When I Was Cruel, that this is Elvis making an angry rock and roll record and all of that. It's more than that. I think that's a very simplistic view, isn't it, that some people reached for. But I think Alibi is one of the tracks that would lead you to think that. And I just took out the Rolling Stone review from the time. Barry Walters said, "You know the man is back on track on Alibi when he conjures a sentiment that sums up the central conflict of nearly all of his greatest songs. I love you just as much as I hate your guts. He spews it in that vengeful, articulately unhinged manner that only he can muster."
Wow. First of all, that is such an interesting writer to have been the person writing about that. Like, David Fricke was there. Why would he not have written that? But yeah, it's true. And that also is a part of why it takes me back to that time and place, because I was in this is post 9/11 New York. And black leather New York, like, it was rocker, hipster New York. So I was spending a lot of time walking to nightclubs to see bands, going to bars to hang out with friends. And there was definitely a sense, not really of danger, but I mean, by the next year, I would get mugged in Williamsburg, so it wasn't undangerous. Right. A sense of like needing to have a sneer on your face. Like, I made a game out of making eye contact with men to make sure they were clear I wasn't going to move on the sidewalk for them. I will run into you.
Yeah.
So that it was like an armor. It was the function in my life. And as much as this return to early Elvis Costello was interesting, it was also the tone of things that just really fit into my everyday life at the time.
You're listening to Dangerous Amusements. This had better be worth all of the breath I'm wasting.
Let's stay in the 2000s for a moment, because you went to another amazing show a couple of years, I guess, after this came out. And like A Case for a Song, this is something that I just really love re-watching over and over again, because there are some incredible performances on it. You were at the VH1 show where Elvis appears with Billy Joe Armstrong, Fiona Apple, Death Cab for Cutie. Just, I am insanely jealous of this. So just tell me about that. What was that like?
It was so bizarre. First of all, it was in Atlantic City on the boardwalk, which is in one of the hotels, which is the strangest thing. I've wondered for years why that taping was there, because it worked and it was a big enough room. The room actually arguably was too big. I might have liked it to be at the Beacon Theater, which is somewhere Elvis plays pretty much every time he's in New York now. But it was so good. Like, I went because I worked for MTV and VH1 as its sister network, but also I was working with Death Cab for Cutie a lot at that time. That's between the Transatlanticism and Plans era when this show happened. And we were very closely collaborating. So it was also to see them. And I was working with Fiona Apple a lot at that time as well, because that was the album with the weird fruit on it. I literally have a gold plaque for this album hanging in my living room, but I can't remember the name of it. But it was to see both of those artists as well. And oh my God, Fiona Apple's set, I knew it was going to be good. And I knew that her depth of fandom for him was intense, but it was so much better than I could have even imagined. Her version of Shabby Doll just wrecked the whole room. Like, I feel like Elvis came out on the stage and didn't even totally know where to insert himself into that, because she embodied that song. It was truly physically a part of her. And nobody else was doing that with these songs. There's a sense of him being such an elder state man, and these bands are all huge fans of his, which is why they've agreed to do it. But it's a tribute. And she's with that song, just like beating herself up emotionally. And it was like one of the best performances I've ever seen.
Yeah. And the version of I Want You as well is one of the most intense and incredible performances. The atmosphere in the place must have been off the charts, wasn't it, when they were playing?
It was when Fiona was on, especially. The crowd was really rowdy for Billie Joe Armstrong, and the crowd was really, like, kind of flat for Death Cab. I mean, it was fine. But it felt, the room was so big that it felt a little impersonal sometimes. Mm. Something about the heightened emotion of Fiona seemed to really draw people in. But it was kind of, it felt like a big arena rock show, you know, when Billy Joe did his songs. And Elvis did songs after that. Obviously, like, they did him last in the evening because that's just proper. And it didn't work great. Like, things felt a little smaller following Billy Joe. It just felt a little like a denouement more than a finale. And I think that it doesn't come across in the taping. So I believe that Alex Coletti was the executive producer of that, and he did a lot. He did the whole Unplugged franchise on MTV. He is really a genius, and he later would be the EP who worked on the Sundance show with Elvis. They have a long history together. But I just, it didn't totally, the lineup didn't totally work in the room. And personally, I know Billy Joe was on because obviously Green Day were huge then. This is the American Idiot era and couldn't have been bigger, and you need that for TV and for ratings. But I'm not totally sure that it worked. It made sense. Billy Joe's a big fan for sure. That Elvis is a big influence on him, just in terms of the actual live experience. It felt a little off kilter for me.
I'm still jealous though, so.
It was still an excellent evening.
So this is your song choice from the 2010s for the playlist, and this is Cinco Minutos Con Vos, which came out on the album made by Elvis with The Roots, Wise Up Ghost. This is a great track. Why have you picked this one?
So again, Elvis, first of all, continually releases things that connect with me when I'm in these different phases of life. And this Roots album, I was just like, what is this man doing now? Is it okay if Elvis gets into hip hop and plays with The Roots? Like, it's not appropriation. Obviously, The Roots would be into it. Obviously, Questlove will be into it. But like, is this going to be weird? Can he keep up with hip hop? Because I don't know. He hasn't been in this world. And it was very good. Like, it's an excellent album. This song, though, like, there just aren't that many duets for him other than, you know, with Diana. So this was so unexpected to have a duet with a young up-and-coming band, a male-female duet in dual languages. Nothing about this was what I expected, but there's such a great romanticism to this song that it really just pulls me in. And it's just, something is so seductive about it. It's the drums it's Questlove and his drums, which are beautiful, and the syncopation is gripping to me, but the way that their voices dance around each other, I am obsessed with it. It's just so beautiful. Mi padre sabía, me lo susurró. Vete a Montevideo y espérame ahí. Por dónde empezar, escuchando siempre están por cinco minutos o más si te atreves. Sirenas lamentan la plaga que encuentran. Las balas caen y te harán desaparecer. El faro oscurece, hay poca esperanza. Cinco minutos son dos.
La Marisol performing the other part of this song as well. And I think conceptually this is so interesting, isn't it? Because Wise Up Ghost, so much of that record is about taking sonic elements of Elvis's career and retooling them for a new record. Whereas this one, it's actually taking a subject matter and spinning it round and looking the other way. This, of course, the spiritual follow-up to Shipbuilding, where Elvis is talking about, you know, British soldiers going off to fight in the Falklands War. And then on this one, he's spinning it round and looking at things from the other perspective. And he said, I never really thought about writing a similar human story as if you were on the other side of that conflict. It's taken 30 years to think of something I felt right about. Rather than write about something I don't know, I simply wanted to write a story about a girl who's waiting for her father to arrive home while he's being pushed out of an aeroplane somewhere. So it's, wow. As well as being aurally beautiful, it's it packs a bit of a lyrical punch as well.
Wow, that's heartbreaking. That's just, but how very appropriate the layers and layers of music nerdery, and that is just so perfectly Elvis. Wow, I love that. Also, Shipbuilding is just so stunningly beautiful that, of course, that makes sense that they're bookends to each other. The haunting quality, the sadness of it, the wanting of it. Like, there's a real desire there. Yeah, totally makes sense.
Yeah. A further bit to that quote that Elvis gave in 2013, he says, the only reason I raise this song now is because people are still being taken away in our name, taken away in aeroplanes, flown off to various places, and we don't know what's being done to them. Those used to be things that the bad guys did. We could point at them as say, they're the bad guys. We can't do that now because now we're the bad guys. And you think, well, that's 10 years ago, and things have only really got worse in the decade that's followed since then. So this, you know, when you think of it in context, this song just gets ever more powerful when you listen to it.
True. I mean, the Iraq conflict is technically over, I suppose, but the Afghani conflict is not. And how many other conflicts have begun? Ooh, it's depressing. Thanks, Stu. Thanks. I'm going to uplift the listeners with this story. So I went to the record release performance slash party for this album, and it was at Brooklyn Bowl in Brooklyn, obviously. It happened to be on my 35th birthday, the actual night of it. And I didn't have a ticket. One of my coworkers, who knew I was a huge fan, secretly wrangled a pair of tickets and was like, let me take you to drinks, and takes me to Brooklyn. And then she's like, hey, we're going to go over here. And I was like, what do you mean? Are we going to the Elvis Costello concert? And we were, and it was so cool. I hadn't seen him anywhere that small and intimate ever before. And it was so loud because the Roots full band was just like unmitigated. It was amazing. It was just so punchy and so full of life. And we were standing on like a VIP section that was heightened over to the stage left. And I could see everything for once, which is amazing. I'm 5'4", and that's not always the case wherever I go. So it was a very special night to me, and I will truly never, never forget it. So it pays to tell people when you're a super fan of someone. You never know what they might turn up with for you.
Yeah. We've had a few people on who were at that gig as well, and everyone has raved about it because they do songs from Wise Up Ghost. They do a couple of other Elvis songs. And then is that when they did Ghost Town and I Found Out by Lennon as well? Amazing.
Yes. Ghost Town was actually great. That was very rollicking, and the whole crowd's response was like just yelling and thrilled. It was very cute. Gosh, I forgot that it happened. I'm glad that you said that.
Yeah. Well, we did ask Steve Mandel when he was on if there was any prospect that that had been recorded in a fashion which could be released as a live album. And I don't think it was, unfortunately. But in a way, that makes it all the more special for those of you who were at the gig, doesn't it? It exists in your memory of that night and a birthday night as well. You can't get much more special than that.
I guess so. But I mean, I think probably the PA system, which then was not great, Brooklyn Bowl was fairly new. Now they're very used to having concerts. I'm sure that they've upgraded everything. But it probably would have been on par with Hollywood High. And I kind of would like to hear that recording and just see what they got. But yes, no complaints, really. No complaints.
No. And this is a wonderful song that you're adding to the playlist as well, Cinco Minutos Con Vos, written by Elvis with Questlove and Steve Mandel, and then performed with The Roots. And we've got La Marisol on vocals, Ray Angry, James Poyser, Kirk Douglas, Mark Kelly, Frankie Knuckles, Matt Cappy, and Corey Riker is on the saxophones for that one as well, released on the album Wise Up Ghost in 2013.
From blue flower to tell just where my fortune fell. About a body on my caution before I lay beneath his spell. And he said, do you by chance know wrong from right?
Final song that you're adding onto the playlist for us, bringing us right up to date into the 2020s. And this is a wonderful song from the album The Boy Named Iv. This is The Difference.
So if you ask me again in 6 years to pick my favorite Elvis song from this decade, obviously the answer might be different. We're working with limited releases at this point, and God knows where this man's going to go and take us, clearly, if history has taught us anything. But it's, again, like everything from when I caught up to Elvis in the 2000s until the present has been something that just jumped out to me on first listen, all the things that I've selected today. And this is one of those. And I'm actually kind of thrilled to hear that so many other people feel the same way, because it does just have an instant appeal. And this isn't an album I've sat with extensively or listened to repeatedly. But every year since, gosh, I think about 2016, I've started making my favorite songs of the year playlist, and I add stuff to it as I go. And usually for almost every new album that comes out that I listen to all the way through, there's one song, like there's something that's just the clear winner, and it immediately goes on that playlist. And by the end of the year, I might have moved on to something else or listened to another song more. This was that song, though, for 2022 from the Elvis album, and I haven't moved on. And sometimes it gets reinforced because I do listen to those playlists a lot through the year as it goes on to see how my music taste is shaping up, and also because it's full of stuff that I like. I haven't moved off of, for this album, for Elvis this decade, I haven't moved off of this song. Like, it's got me in its grip. And I really don't know why. Would you like to tell me about what some other people have said? Is there a consensus on why this song is so,
I think,
beloved already?
Yeah, I think some people have picked out that really ascending section of the song, like, do you know, as being a really that's so appealing when they go up like that. And I think musically, and people say this about the album as a whole, don't they, that it contains some of the stylings of the best of Elvis and the Attractions now being done with the Impostors. And I think maybe the difference fits into that category as well. I mean, for me, I love the lyrics, that whole, you know, she took the knife and showed me the difference. It's got that slight, you know, sense of menace about it that so many Elvis songs have. It's a great song, definitely a highlight for me from this record and from the last decade, maybe.
You've definitely named two of my favorite things about Elvis, the lyricism, the cutting lyricism, and Steve Neve's keyboard playing, which is the da-da-da-da-da-da. So yeah, I mean, those things, it's instantly familiar because of those things. I don't know that those are exactly the things that make me like it. You know, sometimes people just stumble onto the magic combination. That's what makes the best pop songs the best pop songs sometimes. It's just like that thing that makes it get stuck in your head, that thing that just turns the key and makes it instantly likable. And I love the idea that Elvis Costello is still stumbling on those things this far into his career, this far into his songwriting. It would be so easy to get stuck off in something esoteric or complicated. He's done a lot of intellectual exercises with music, and to be able to return to straightforward Americana and pop songwriting and write something that so many people who are fans of him, who have been on this podcast like already, I think that speaks very well to his chops and his skills.
Yes. And as you say, there's always something different or something new coming around the corner. And one of the interesting things with The Difference and some of the other songs from this period is that they were inspired by that Polish movie Cold War, directed by Paweł Pawlowski. And then that film has now been adapted for the stage, including some of the Elvis songs by Conor McPherson, directed by Rupert Gould. And it's, as we're recording this, I think it's just coming to the end of its run at the Almeida Theatre in London, which started back in November. But again, there's just another avenue, isn't it? Elvis songs being adapted for the stage. And Conor McPherson did, I don't know if you've seen it, The Girl from the North Country, using all of the Bob Dylan songs, which I saw last year in Liverpool and absolutely loved. And this sort of tantalising prospect that there might be something in that direction from Elvis as well really excites me.
I am not a fan of musical theatre, but I would go to see an Elvis Costello jukebox musical in a heartbeat. And plus, I can already imagine a story arc for it. Obviously. Wow. Yes. Please let that happen. Let's put that on our bingo card for this decade.
Absolutely. We would like to hear that. So Elvis, talking about The Difference, he said he was trying to transpose into a seduction between two people approximately the same age. What would it be like if a boy who thinks he's more experienced is trying to seduce a woman only to discover that she knows much more about this scenario than he thinks?
Well, I'm 46 and not unmarried, so maybe that's what I relate to in this song.
Yeah, no, it's a lovely song, isn't it? And such a great record as well. It's not, sometimes you get a new record and you play it for weeks or months afterwards and then it dies away. The Boy Named Iv has not really left my playlist at all since it came out, and we're now just, 2 years since it came out. I think it more than holds its own in Elvis's canon. I don't know what you think.
I agree with that. I mean, I think it could be heralded as a return to that early 80s Elvis if, you know, any lazy music writers wanted to do that. And that wouldn't be incorrect. And it has all the appeal of those things as Elvis became more and more pop before he became more and more morose in that decade. And I think those are some of my favorite in his albums in terms of standing the test of time. Like, I will forever go back to Imperial Bedroom, and I will forever go back to, gosh, every day I write the book, I sing in my car so often that some people might think I'm unwell. So yes, I agree. This also does that for me. There's never a time that this playlist comes up and I skip that song. I'm never tired of this song. I never don't want to hear it, which is remarkable for me. That does not match my current listening habits.
Yeah. Recorded with The Impostors and produced by Costello and Sebastian Criss and released in 2022. Just to bring us to a close, We've talked a little bit about what might be next for Elvis and one or two of the things that we might love to hear from him. I mean, what are your hopes as a fan? What would you, is it more live gigs? Is it a particular thing you'd love to hear on record from him?
For me, I've really enjoyed the concerts where he has done more of a sit-down show and explored the back catalog, but in alternate versions. I went to see him in Dallas at the Majestic do one of those shows, and it was a good break because I've seen several of the spinning wheel shows. It was a good format, a different thing, and it really hits on the very first song that I chose, this idea of show me the insides of Elvis Costello, show me the things that I don't know, the things that got transformed in the name of creating an image, in the name of marketing. Like, what was your real intention? And show me the deep cuts that you're interested in, like the stuff off of his albums that I may have skipped over, the artists who influence him. He's adapting all of those things for that particular brand of tour. And I like it. As much as I love to go see a rowdy show with the Imposters, I really do like those very long, very exploratory shows. So I want more of those. He also doesn't play Texas that often, and I wonder if it's political. I wouldn't blame him if it is. He was just here, though, and now I know it will be 2 or 3 years before he comes back. I need more. I'm going to need more tours that come to Dallas. That's primarily the top of my list. As far as recordings, I'm along for the ride. You know, like, I don't like fans of bands who have a particular list of demands. And I'm as intellectually curious, if not, you know, less so than Elvis. I want to know where he's going. If he's going to explore something weird, I'm into it. Let's go down a rabbit hole. I've got the time.
Lovely. But unfortunately, we're out of time now for our conversation. But a lovely note to leave it on, because we've got plenty that we're hoping for, plenty to look forward to from Elvis as well, I'm sure. Courtney, this has been great. Some great song choices and your stories behind them. And of course, some incredible stories of going to gigs that have left me genuinely green with envy as I've been listening to them. Thanks so much for coming on and chatting to us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always a pleasure to talk Elvis Costello, and it was a pleasure to talk to you, Stu.
Thank you to Courtney. Some brilliant song choices and wonderful gig memories there. You can find Courtney on social media as Courtney E. Smith, and her terrific show, Songs My Ex Ruined, is available wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can follow Dangerous Amusements on X and Instagram, and find my website at dangerousamusements.co.uk. The music for the show is performed by Gary Mulcahy.
Thanks for listening to Dangerous Amusements, sending you our love and vicious kisses.